is the amazing Corky Siegel with his chamber blues that he started 20-some years ago and is still going strong. I'm Rick Cogan. The show is After Hours, and my guest for the first 45 minutes is Mary Fonz, who tells me that she's been on this show before. That's how we met. I was standing outside the Tribune Tower, and you said, "Hi, Rick, I'm Mary Fonz." And I went, "Hi, how are you?" You run here for what, Mary?
I was here years ago with Mark Smith, the founder of the Poetry Slam.
You always have to say the great Mark Smith.
Yeah, and so what, right?
Yeah, right.
The great Mark Smith, creator of the Poetry Slam. When I first got to Chicago, like 15 years ago, I got
from?
Into the slam. Iowa, small town in Iowa. Winterset, John Wayne's birthplace.
And is that museum? That museum's not still out there,
it's
is it?
So there.
Is it?
And it just expanded.
Wow,
and
good.
The covered bridges of Madison County is out there. And my mom just bought the movie theater in our hometown on the square and renovated it.
What brought you to Chicago?
Well, theater and slam is how I got into slam poetry. And so I was on your show with Mark Smith and some other scallywag poets.
Yeah, they're all scallywags.
Oh, yeah.
You're all scallywags.
Tell me about it. Yeah.
But what intrigued me so much in our little conversation outside is you told me you were a quilter.
Yeah.
And I am fascinated with that kind of, I call it with all due respect, an artistic subculture.
Totally.
Is that accurate?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's not too sub of a subculture. I mean, there are 21
well,
million.
I think, you know, but it probably it's a subculture to me sitting in Tribune Tower and not being in touch with.
Right.
I know there are quilters all over this world.
Mm-hmm.
How many quilters are there?
21 million in America.
There's a stunning figure.
I know.
There's a stunning number.
I got another one for you. I got
yes.
another number. $4 billion a year annually. $4 billion a year industry.
Why is it in an urban environment so, I'm going to say, underappreciated?
Well, I think there's a sense that quilting is still something that only grandmas do. And it's true, another number for
grandmas on the farm
yeah,
or someplace.
Grandmas
yeah.
on the farm and there are reasons for that sort of but people don't appreciate that while the average age of the quilter is 60s, early 60s or something. People have always been making we've always made quilts. It's the democratic art, you know. Anyone who wants to make a quilt can sort of figure out how to make one. And as long as we're made of flesh and blood, people will be making quilts. I mean, you can't wrap a baby in an iPad is what I like to say. So people are making quilts even then, and young people sort of come to it, not 20-somethings, but 30, 40-somethings. People have babies. They graduate from college. They get married. And there's nothing like a quilt. There's nothing like a quilt. So, you know, the
good
urban
point to make and also to make for your friend's little infant. And
yeah.
that's the gateway drug.
Yes, the gateway drug. That's what we say.
Gateway drug to quilting.
Exactly.
How did you, your mother is a famous, famous, world-renowned quilter.
That's true.
Tell me the difference between a professional quilter and your, I don't want to say average quilter, but one who does it non-professionally.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. My mom is one half of the Fonz and Porter brand, which is kind of a Betty Crocker kind of brand in the quilt industry. And she has been – so when we say – actually, this is something to make the distinction about. When I say I'm a professional quilter or that my mom is a professional quilter or a famous quilter, it's not that she's making quilts and selling them for thousands and thousands of dollars.
Right.
There are those people who do that. But the people who become professional in the quilt industry are doing things like what I'm doing now, writing books, teaching all over
traveling around the country.
I write a column.
For who?
Give lectures. Quilts.com, Quilts Inc. It's a big, you know, they put on the biggest quilt market, the conventions. And I mean, it's huge. It's just huge. And I feel really lucky. I didn't think I'd be doing this. I mean, I came to Chicago.
Yeah, you came to Chicago to be a poet.
Yeah.
To be
there's
a
more
poet.
Money in quilting
yes,
than poetry.
Yes, yeah, you would think.
Yeah, yeah.
No
I still I still do some poetry gigs, though, like out in the burbs for the suburbs, do Writer's Week stuff. And I was a writer before I was a quilter. So now I'm blending the writing and the quilting more and more.
Let's talk for a few minutes about your coming here.
Yeah.
And getting involved in the whole slam scene, which takes place Sunday nights generally. I mean, it takes place all over the place, but the most famous one takes place at the Green Mill.
The best one.
On Sunday nights. How did you get together with that crowd?
I had a boyfriend when I was in college who moved to New York City, and I went to visit him. And I went to the New Eurekan Poets Cafe, you know, Bob Holman and all those guys.
Oh, yeah, Bob's been in here, yeah.
Yeah. So they're all so grumpy these days, Bob and Mark and everybody, but I love them. But I saw him do poetry. I saw this guy I was seeing, and it was just electric. And he was really good at it, and he lost. Of course, the best poets always lose, you know. But I thought to myself, I could probably do that. But I thought at the time, because I grew up in Iowa, went to the University of Iowa, the only performance I really knew was acting. And so I came to Chicago, and I started doing some acting. But I hated being
theater.
Other people. Yeah, theater, you know, stage stuff.
Yeah.
And but when I remembered seeing Slam, and I remembered that you could write your own stuff. You know, it was your own stuff. And so I went to the Green Mill, and I signed up for the Slam. I had like two poems, you know. And I won that night. I guess I just said the best poet always loses. But that night, the best poet won.
Right,
you know?
Of course.
And Mark Smith
of
looked at me, and he was like, I like you. I like you. And I got the blessing, you know, the benediction.
That's a lot. That's
Seriously,
that's a lot. Mark doesn't toss compliments around at all.
No. So I was like, really, he really encouraged me. I mean, I owe him truly a lot.
Had you done performance studies?
No.
At Iowa? Had you been in theater?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, theater degree, valedictorian theater person. But I liked the stage. I liked speaking publicly. But I didn't really want to play Masha, you know, in some Chekhov play for the rest of my life. And I helped start the Gift Theater Company. You might know Michael Thornton, Patrick Thornton.
And, yeah, on the Northwest Side.
Yeah, Jeff Park.
Yeah.
So I did that. But then eventually I moved away from it. And
why?
Because
if any of this gets too personal, the reason I want you on for 45 minutes is so people can get to know you, because it's like, you know, instead of like, hey, what's your new quilting book? Yeah.
No, I I'll overshare. You'll have to pull me back,
good,
you know,
good,
from
good,
things.
Good, good,
because part of my quilting story is I was very ill. And anyway, so we can talk
about
get
that. Into
but,
it.
But I got I was making a living as a writer and as a performer, really, in a neo-feature.
Writing what?
Anything. The amazing Book of Dogs. You know, there was a company out in Lincolnwood who did that kind of book, Haunted Places of Illinois. I mean, I was freelancing. Anything.
Yeah,
textbook
yeah.
content, any sorts of things I can write. Oh, gosh, business-to-business papers.
And so you were making a living here.
Yeah, I was doing.
And were you drawn away from theater? And if so, why?
Well, because of quilting. Because my mom, who started a show on public television years ago, Fonz and Porter's Love of Quilting on PBS, which is nationwide, WTTW, I think, is who
carries
airs
it
here.
In mm-hmm. a weird way TTW does things.
Yes, exactly. And it's on the Create Network. And anyway, it's on in every market, I think. So, but she and her business partner sold the business. Business partner wanted to get out. I had shown an early interest in quilting. And so the powers that be that own the company now, the Fonz and Porter company,
said, hey, we need a young demographic.
Precisely.
Here.
And they kind of licked their chops and were, you know, it was like Fonz 2.0. Great. Do you want to be on the show? Do you want to be, you know, work with your mom a little bit? And it was like,
I needed the
gig, man.
That's a very appealing offer, though. I'm talking this hour and Mary Fonz, you can go to her website, which is an easy website to find, MaryFonz.com. She is now entering the world of TV, and after a short commercial break, we'll find out what that was like for her. I first have to tell you that, I don't have to tell you anything. So do it, Aubrey. Run some commercials. I'm playing Corky Siegel on Chamber Blues this hour because I'm having a couple rock and rollers in here for the second hour, and it will be a nice contrast, I think. This hour I have Mary Fonz in here talking about her life as a writer and a poet, but mostly as a quilter and an advocate, is what I'm going to call you, for the art of quilting. Before we get into your TV career, is quilting an art? Is it a craft? Is it an art? You know, I'm not big on labels, but I'm curious how you would define it.
It's the question that has a different answer, you know.
Depending on where you are.
It's true. Yeah. I mean, there are quilters who made quilts in the 19th century. The 19th century was really the grand, you know, the Belle Epoque, right? Or was that the right word? Yeah.
The golden age.
The golden age. Because of textile production in this country. So this is a little bit of a roundabout way to get to what you asked me, but it's important, and I think it's you'll find it interesting. People have a concept that quilts were made because of scarcity of material, that we had to...
Scraps of fabric, yeah.
Right. But in fact, the opposite is true. We have quilts because textile manufacturing in this country became what it was. The Industrial Revolution happened before we made our own cloth here. We had to import everything from England, which came to us if it was printed by way of India. So it was very, very, very expensive, certainly in colonial times and until the Industrial Revolution really changed things. So it's actually abundance of material that led to quilting, and you can't really make a scrap quilt unless you have extra fabric left over. So this in the 19th century, when women were making these quilts, they were sometimes so exquisite.
What compelled? I'm sure quilting is an ancient art,
yes,
or craft.
Yeah, right.
But what compelled the original quilt?
Yeah.
Do you think? You probably know. But.
Well, you know, keeping your sanity out on the wagon train.
Yeah.
You know, partly. But women who made these things, these beautiful coverlets, these beautiful quilts, today, if they were around, they'd be working on the Human Genome Project. I mean, some of these quilts are so extraordinary, you can hardly believe. They look untouched by human hands, some of these beautiful, intricate quilts. Others are just utilitarian, and they are made of scraps, denim overalls, you know, wool scraps of other things. So there were subsistence quilts. There were utilitarian quilts. But there were also, so those would be sort of craft, you know, workaday home stuff, domestic goods. But then there are these other quilts, and they transcend. It's graphic design. It's art for sure.
Yeah. No question.
Yeah.
So some wise or innovative television producer says, hey, you should be on TV with your mom. And you did.
I needed the gig, man.
And you didn't know, but at the time, you were an inept quilter, were you not?
It's true. I didn't grow up sewing at mom's knee.
Yeah.
Because for her, my mom's a single mom. I got two sisters, one on either side, growing up in Iowa. And my dad was totally out of the picture. And she raised us on this quilting thing, you know, and she helped build this big industry. She was really on the ground floor building this big industry with other women like her who needed to put food on the table. And so I didn't start sewing with her when I was a kid. We were encouraged to do creative things. We were artsy kids. But it was my mom's work.
Right.
Quilting was her work. So I didn't really get into it. So I was 28 when I really started. I had my quilt epiphany, I call it. I had a catastrophic illness. I got married. I got divorced. It was really a sort of a hellish time.
You were living in Chicago at the time.
Yeah. And working as this, you know, doing poetry gigs and writing and all this. But I sort of woke up in the middle of the night during this time of just great tumult and, you know, it was really hard. And I like to say that I had this quilt epiphany. I realized when life as you know it is torn into a million pieces, it makes perfectly good sense to tear up perfectly good fabric and sew them back together again, you know. And so I just jumped in, but I didn't know what I was doing. So when they asked me to be on the show, I was a total rookie.
Did you know how to sew?
Barely.
And sewing is the basis, I would suppose, of quilting.
You really have to sew it together.
And you do that. So you were a novice.
I was a novice.
But it was still an appealing notion to work with your mom.
Totally. And she was there. She could protect me. You know, those big four cameras, and we film at Iowa Public Television. This would have been in...
What was the format of the show? Hi, honey. This is my daughter. Let's make a quilt today. I mean, what was the format of the show?
Yeah.
Basically?
It's still on, you know, and I'm on hiatus. I'm going back in the fall, though. I'll be on TV again. You open and you say, welcome to, you know, Love of Quilting. And, you know, let's take a look at the quilt we're going to take a look at today, you know. And so we pan over to the quilt that's either made by one of us or by
someone you admire.
Exactly. And then we usually have three teaching objectives, you know. So we pick out three elements of the construction of this quilt or the design of it or so on. And then we go through these three things. It's live to tape, so it's not scripted. We just start extemporaneously doing things, hitting all the marks. The clock out in the darkness of the studio that I have to watch is 21 minutes, counts down from 21 minutes. There may be a clock very similar. And so you have to kind of land the plane, you know, in
so
that time.
Was your mom in essence teaching you as a means to teach the audience?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I was the rookie asking all the dumb questions, you know, and it was helpful. We had a lot of letters from people who hated me at first. They really did, because you have women in Omaha watching the show and I'm this young upstart. I'm the kid. And so they're like, right, you know, and I don't know what I'm doing. And we got letters, you know, sometimes when they're handwritten, you know, you're really in trouble when there's this handwritten letter from the Sticks. And I'm from the Sticks, so
but
I don't want to offend.
But sure, the internet also must have been, can be really, really brutal and demoralizing.
Yeah, there's pockets of trolls who just hate you, you know. But I did get hateful things said about me from people who said, I can't learn from a beginner. I've been doing this for 30 years. And then other people said, I can watch the show now and follow it because I'm new. And Mary asks the dumb questions that I have had in the past. But Mom, you know, Marianne and Liz never stopped at these basic things because they assumed everybody knew them. So I was the rookie asking those questions.
Was it fun for you? When obviously you got paid, it was modestly lucrative.
PBS. I mean, there's no money.
I know. But modestly lucrative. Was it also fun for you?
I really love my mom.
Yeah.
I respect the hell out of that woman. I mean, we get on each other's nerves too. I get on her nerves as much as she gets on mine. But she's just wonderful, and I respect her. I have a lot to learn from her, and so that was great. That was always really fun. And that mother-daughter thing is magic. I mean, two generations of people quilting, and we're kind of fun.
To me, it sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, people really they caught into it.
And they eventually warmed it to you.
Yeah. And I got better. I mean, what's cool is if you watch the show from the time I started till now, and you you sort of sped up the show, time lapse, you see a quilter evolving and growing before your very eyes. It's really great. It's because anybody can do this. You can start from knowing very little and in a matter of years be making quilts that are, you know, kind of great.
How good are you now?
I'm a better designer than I am technically. I'm not that great with my corners match and I do all this stuff, but I'm better with color than I am with the sewing machine.
How hard is it to learn? You know, one thing that appeals to me about it is that it is an old art. It's not being designed by computer. I suppose you could, you know, use a computer to help you design.
We have sewing machines with laser beams on them now.
Designed? Do you really?
Yeah.
Do you really?
Well, yeah.
and you need to use sewing machines rather than by hand.
Well,
is there any you know sort of heightened joy in doing it by hand?
Heightened joy? No.
It's too hard.
My mom says it like this. If you want to go to the grocery store, you know, you can walk, depending on where you live. You know, in a small town.
Right, right.
In a small town, you can walk to the store and you see all the flowers, you smell the flowers, you think, have your walking thoughts. Or if you need to get there a little faster, you get on a bike, you know, and get there faster. Or you can get in the car and you're there right away, but you may miss some things. We say you can quilt a quilt by hand, by machine, or by credit card. You can hire other people to do it for you, to quilt your quilt. And a distinction that some people might not know is...
I mean, are you saying you can design a quilt and have someone manufacture it for you?
Well, what I mean is a quilt is three layers. It's the top, which is the beautiful patchwork colors.
Right.
And then there's the batting, which is the fluffy stuff, and then a backing. And it's not that's the quilt sandwich. And it's not a quilt until it's quilted. So when you stitch through those layers.
Interesting. Okay, now I have just learned something. Yeah.
Some quilters just like making the top. They like doing the patchwork and with all the fun colors and the fabrics. And some people really are master quilters, or they just really like the quilting part of it. So you can quilt your quilt by hand with a needle and thread. You can do that. You can also do the piecing by hand, which nobody does anymore. I mean, ugh, this is like, no, not
fun. What do
you
mean by piecing?
The piecing is making the patchwork top. So you cut all your patches and you put them together in a beautiful pattern.
And then you sew them together and sew them into the quilt.
Quilt those layers together, exactly. So some people, so you can do that all by hand. But the sewing machine, I mean, quilters have always been early adapters. Everybody in America, just about, by 1860, had a sewing machine.
Yeah.
So for the people, there's always some guy on an airplane when I'm flying to my gigs. If we get to talking, we'll talk about what I do for a living. And he'll say, so do you make your quilts by hand? And I'll say, yes. And I know what he's thinking. And I say, I mean, I do use a sewing machine. Yeah. And some, you know, he knows so much. A little light goes out of his eyes, you know, and he's like, oh, that's too bad. You know,
it's like, yeah, what's wrong with you?
It's like women have been using their sewing machines for really generations.
This is Mary Fonz. This is absolutely, to me, fascinating. I'm sure it is to you listeners, too. I was going to keep Mary till 9:45, but now, Lisa, I'm going to keep her all the way to 10. This
yes.
is just too interesting. Corky Siegel, ladies and gentlemen, with his Chamber Blues. I'm Rick Kogan, and my guest is Mary Fonz, who is a writer and an actor and a poet and a quilter and a television star, and we are talking about, we're all over the place talking about art and quilting and the history of quilting. Why, Mary, we were talking off the air that the post-World War, quilting sort of took a dive in popularity post-World War II, because I guess because everybody in the world had a bunch of new gizmos to play with, and quilting took a back seat to the new technologies that were out there. When was it revived?
In 1971, there was an exhibit at the Whitney Museum of Art in New York City. And people, you know, the quilts I was talking about earlier with those intricate, you know, leaves and beautiful flowers and all these this art stuff, museums have always collected some of those quilts, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The Art Institute has them, you know, the Met has
quilts. How big a collection at the Art Institute?
That's a good question. I got to
And are they on exhibit?
They no, not all the time,
yeah.
No. But I got to go into the stacks or the storage area and see a few. They've got some really important quilts, American quilts. But museums have collected some of these, early colonial stuff, whatever. But very few museums, hardly any. We're collecting the humble quilts from the prairie, you
yeah.
know, the log cabin is a quilt. Some people will, they have an image of that, the churn dash, you know, streak of lightning, like these, the quilts that you, when you think of a patchwork quilt, you think of these quilts, but because they were not considered art, they were considered woman's work, which
right.
is a whole other thing. Museums were not collecting these things, but there were collectors who saw the value in these humble unsigned, you know, anonymous maker, unidentified, you know, nameless
you know,
pieces of work.
It occurs to me, you know, in yeah. the same way that people, it took decades for people to think of photographs
right.
as art.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Before they were collecting. I just saw a documentary about Robert Mapplethorpe. But it took decades before museums and the public in general deemed photography art.
I have never thought about that as.
Do you
being
see
a
any
parallel?
Similarity? There
it's
is
so
a. There
interesting.
Is.
Yeah. I got to think about that more. But there were two collectors in particular, Jonathan Holstein and Gail Vanderhoof, and they were collecting quilts in the 60s, and they were connected in the art world, and the quilts they were collecting were these humble from Kentucky, Iowa, you know, California. And they were connected in the art world. They knew Lichtenstein.
Okay.
And so they took their quilts to the people at the Whitney Museum of Art, and they said, you need to look at these things. You know, these are extraordinary pieces of graphic art. I mean, they need to be hung in a museum. And so the Whitney agreed, and in 1971, the exhibit Abstract Art in American Quilts was put up, and for the first time, quilts were taken off the bed and put onto the walls of a museum.
That must have been a sensation.
Ben Brantley of the New York Times.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, he said it was the best thing to happen to the New York art scene in 10 years. There were lines around the block. It toured the country. So this was 1971. So that happened, and that was the seminal thing. And then 5 years later, the bicentennial. And the bicentennial was part of this the Great American Quilt Revival. So after the World War II, during the 1950s, everybody had their gizmos. Quilting was very old-fashioned. Only grandmas made quilts,
which
is the prevailing idea of who makes quilts. But because of the Whitney exhibit and the bicentennial, a groundswell of interest in the American quilt happened. And since then, I mean,
Was your mother caught up in that groundswell?
Yep. She met Liz Porter at a quilting class in 1975. Given by the Extension Office in my hometown of Winterset, Iowa.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, they were part of all that.
How often are there exhibitions of quilting around this country these days? Because you do travel extensively.
I do, a lot.
To talk quilting and to show quilting.
Well, the thing, so museums have shows. In 2002, the G's Bend quilts. Some people who don't know much about quilting know about that, and they know about the AIDS quilt too, which I've been researching a lot.
Sure.
The G's Bend quilts, and it's a town in Alabama, G-E-E-apostrophe-S, G's Bend. Very isolated community. You can only access that place by ferry boat. You know, not even a car ferry. I mean, this is deep south. African-American women in that community for generations have been making these extraordinary quilts. And in 2002, their quilts were exhibited at the Whitney. And that was another watershed sort of thing. And these quilts were on the postage stamp. I mean, they really were famous. So you have sort of blockbuster exhibits from time to time, but not often. Obviously, it was 40 years almost between those two. So you have museums that show quilts, but because there's all these quilters now, active quilters, what's more likely is that you have conventions and you have quilt shows that are put on by quilters. There are quilt guilds. The Dallas Guild, I was just in Dallas yesterday, 400 members in that guild. And their numbers are down a little bit right now.
Yeah.
So that's mostly, most of the quilt shows you'll see are in smaller galleries, smaller places, or put on by aficionados.
Is there a Rembrandt or a Grandma Moses or a Georgia O'Keeffe of quilting? And if so, it just seems that it would be a very, obviously it is an art. You have convinced me of that. It is an art and a craft in the same way that painting is an art. And when someone is at home doing paint by numbers, it's a craft.
Exactly.
Are there famous, world famous quilters? And if so, why?
Yes, there are.
Your mom, perhaps.
Yeah, but it's interesting when you said Rembrandt and things. So I'm thinking about, like, who made the quilts that are these timeless works of art? The most famous quilt, because there are a lot of famous quilters. We call them celebrities, S-E-W.
Celebrities.
I've been called that before in my life.
Are you a celebrity?
Oh, yes. Oh, A-list.
Yeah, you're a TV star.
Yeah,
A-lister.
Exactly. But they're the most famous quilt in the world. It's really, you're asking me these questions. I need to write them down because you've got me thinking photography and all that. So great. Harriet Powers was a woman who was a slave, a freed slave, you know, obviously 19th century. Mm-hmm. She made a quilt called the Bible Quilt. It's called Harriet Powers Bible Quilt. It's in the Smithsonian. And it's a pictorial quilt of scenes from the Bible. And it's probably the most famous. So if there were, like, you know, a canon of, like, the famous quilts, like, you know, like, big time. There are other ones.
Do you think it's beautiful? Do you personally, you think it's beautiful?
Absolutely. It is art by anyone's measure. It is not, it's intricate, but it's well, that's another thing, Rick, is that the African-American story is also really fascinating.
No, I'll bet.
And a lot of times people think that, you know, the G's Bend quilts, which I mentioned before, are kind of the African-American contribution to quilting because they're very famous quilts. But in fact, some of those quilts that were made in the South in the 19th century were made by slaves. Some of the most beautiful quilts that that came out of the South were made by slaves. For the lady of the house, and she got the credit for it sometimes. She didn't even get her name put on it. But it's important for me as I delve more deeply into the history of quilting, because I've become this amateur quilt historian.
No question. There's no question about that.
And I love my topic, so I'm okay being an amateur, because it's, you know, comes from the Latin amare.
Yes, of course.
So, but the African American contribution to quilting is like, it's extraordinary. And the more I learn, the more I'm just amazed by it. So this fine needlework was done by African Americans without question, but no one wrote it down. And that's why quilts are so important to study, because it's the history of this country in women. You know, we didn't get into the history books all the time.
Yeah. So. Well, it's visceral too.
Because
it is visual.
Totally.
Where does one see quilts? I mean, what does your mom do, for instance, to talk of one of these celebrities? What does she do with the quilts that she makes?
We give a lot of quilts away. Quilters, it's crazy. You spend all this time and all this money. It's not a cheap hobby. That is true. It's a democratic art, but, you know, it costs – you can spend a lot.
Well, a laser-guided sewing machine must cost something.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, yeah, tens of thousands of dollars you can spend. But quilters are funny. We spend all this time and all this money, and then we just give our quilts away. In fact, we were talking about how much a quilt might cost. And I like to say, you know, if you wanted to buy a really great quilt, handmade with the machine, you know, a handmade quilt, few people could really afford it. Thousands of dollars. But if you know a quilter who loves you, it's free.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah.
Are there any quilts that are masked? It would seem, with all, you know, 20 million some quilters out there, that someone would have tried to take advantage of this huge crowd commercially and started, you know, making, mass-produced quilts. Is there any of that going on?
Pottery Barn, two words, you know, for you. Crate and Barrel, Pottery Barn. But when... I mean, for a quilter, it's just like sacrilegious.
Yeah.
You know, we just can't stand that. And in fact, Harriet Powers, one of the quilts that she made that the Smithsonian owns in the 80s, the Smithsonian reproduced, they made those quilts in China. They reproduced Harriet Powers' quilt to sell in the gift shop of the Smithsonian. And quilters picketed outside. They
Good
picketed.
For them.
No, there's a lot of quilt scandals. We could talk about quilts.
For them.
That was a big
scandal.
Well,
I want to talk about quilt politics after.
Yeah.
Thank you for so much for staying a whole hour. Yeah. This is fascinating to me. I hope it is to you people. Two of Lisa's, producer Lise Graham's relatives are quilters. There are more out there. Roger Badish is a quilter for all I know. Before we take a break, give me the percentage. There must be a number of men who are quilters.
Definitely.
What's the percentage?
That's great. I need to know that percentage, but I don't know it.
Give me a guess.
Oh, I know. I know personally like four dudes who quilt.
Yeah.
And one of them's a good friend of mine my age.
Are they any good?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's in museums. Luke's in museums. He does art quilting, which is that's a whole other topic.
Different thing.
Yeah.
Well, I want to talk to Mary Fons, and that's MaryFons.com, about what you're sensing out there, because you are meeting, unlike most people stuck in the big city, you are meeting all political stripes when you go out there. And I've often thought that many quilts, the AIDS quilt, for instance, that it is a beautiful and wonderful way to voice one's political feelings. So we will discuss that right after a short commercial break. Corky Siegel, ladies and gentlemen, with his Chamber Blues. I'm Rick Kogan. Mary Fons is my guest for sadly only 10 more minutes, but start reading, for no other reason in the world, start reading the Tribune, because I will have a story about her in the next few weeks, because I'm fascinated with she and her life and this whole culture of quilting. Mary has a TV show. She writes on quilting. She is getting an MFA to do more writing about quilting and writing about other things. She has been a poet and an actress, and she's a lovely, lovely person. MaryFons.com. Mary, you travel the country giving speeches or seminars or... I don't know what else.
Lectures
about quilting.
Yeah.
And you meet a wonderful, I think, because America is
indeed
wonderful, cross-section of people, mostly women.
Yep.
Quilts have always been, and I think are probably likely to become more a avenue for political statements. Do you see that kind of increasing in quilting? There was a piece in the Tribune not long ago by Cindy Dampier about that very thing, that quilts can be a very effective tool, messaging tool. Do you see that happening more?
I'm thinking, is there an increase? That's what I really want to noodle on. I can tell you that women have always, and it is mostly women, so we can
sure.
Women have always put not all women, but many women have put their political views into their quilts. Mm. We didn't get the vote. Hey, it hasn't even been 100 years, you know. So if I was saying that the grand, you know, the golden age of quilting was in the 19th century, well, we couldn't vote that whole century.
Yeah.
So you would find there's a great story of a woman making a quilt called the Whig Rose, W-H-I-G, Whig Rose. It's a certain kind of pattern. And her husband was voting for the other guy. But she was a Whig person. So she, unbeknownst to him, made this quilt called the Whig Rose. And it was, you know, he was sleeping under it every night, you know.
Yeah.
And she thought that was hilarious, which it is. But Grover Cleveland campaign banners, handkerchiefs are stitched into quilts. So there's always been, yeah, it's amazing.
That element in there.
Yeah, it's really in there. Temperance quilts during Prohibition. So that's always been there. But whether it's increasing or not, I'm not sure. Certainly the political quilts that are being made are more visible because of social media and everything. And quilters were early adapters on the internet. We were really, because we can share patterns and share pictures of our quilts. And quilts are wonderful for computers. You have these graphic, bright images, you know, the square.
Of course.
It's so great.
Of course.
But I feel very fortunate that I get to travel as much as I do. 2 days after the election, I was in Kansas City to speak to the Modern Quilt Guild there. And there's this whole new movement, Modern Quilt Movement, which is really great.
What does that mean, Modern Quilt?
Mostly 40-ish, 30-ish, the younger set.
Mm-hmm.
These quilts look more like Joseph Albers paintings or Mark Rothko, very minimalist, lots of negative space. It's the new era, which is great. I'm so glad that they came through because we really needed fresh meat, you know, fresh blood. But I went to Kansas City to speak to the Kansas City Modern Guild. I think there's 200 members there. And it was 2 days after the election, and I opened my big mouth. You know, my host came to pick me up at the airport, and I was like, oh, my God, can you believe what's happened?
Right,
you know, because
I
voted for the other guy. You know, we don't have to get too far into that if you don't want to. But she very quickly changed the subject, and she was good to do it. But it was so odd. She had a purple streak in her hair. She was a young gal, you know, but she was from Indiana. Her parents still live in Indiana. She's living in Kansas, working at a mattress, you know, plant. And so if I was in my little bubble, my little art institute bubble, my Chicago bubble, I would not get to meet the people that I believe we have got to meet. You know,
I think this. You are at a great advantage here, being able to have dialogue with people who, sadly, because of Fox News and everything else, we tend to paint with one big, not to get too artistic here, with one big brush.
Absolutely.
And not realize these are people too,
and share.
I don't know what kind of conversation you're talking about, something that you, for which you all have a mutual passion.
Exactly.
So you're not, you know, going out to the bar afterward and talking politics so much. But I think it's a really healthy thing for you, Mary.
It is, yeah. And I try to. I don't bring up politics, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I was in North Carolina. I mean, Tabor City, North Carolina. I did a retreat. I was invited to be a workshop leader and speak over the weekend for this retreat. And I had a really good – it sounds almost kind of like, I don't know, almost kind of cheesy, but I had a really, really good conversation sitting on the front porch with two women. They were in rocking chairs. I was sitting on the front porch of this retreat center house, and they voted for the other guy. They voted, you know, Trump, and I didn't. And we talked about it. And it's hard. It's hard sometimes because these are good women. These are quilting ladies. They're good. You know, they're not – so anyway, it's hard to listen sometimes, but I get the opportunity to try. And that's
when you get the opportunity to share your own feelings too. What is the future of quilting? I get the sense, because you were this modern quilting thing, that there are, you know, it has always occurred to me that in the, as technology becomes icier and icier and icier and icier, that there is this need to express oneself in non-icy ways. Mm-hmm. Is that part of what's fueling the quilting world and bringing new and younger people into it, where they got sick of Candy Crush and maybe they'd like to do something more substantial?
I think it is true.
Yeah.
It's also a communal thing. I don't do a lot of sewing in groups, but there are guilds and there are these clubs and all kinds of things. So it's a way to have a group of friends and to have a common interest.
With other people.
Yeah, to be with other people. But also, like I said at the top of the show, you can't wrap a baby in an iPad. You know, you can't, if somebody has a child, I suppose you could give them the latest iPhone and they would probably be thrilled. But when the house is burning down, what do you grab?
Yeah.
You probably have your cell phone in your pocket. Okay, so what do you grab? You grab grandma's quilt. Yeah. You know, you grab the photo album, or maybe you grab the hard drive that has your photos on it. I mean, what do we have when we have to take just a few things with us, you know? And a quilt is shelter. They used to put quilts on their wagons, their covered wagons, to keep the arrows from going through to hit the kids in the wagon. So it can be protection in a certain way. It's shelter. It's warmth. It is memories. It is memories. It's material. It has material value, literally. And that's not going to go away as long as we're made of flesh and blood. I believe that. I believe it.
Well, and there may even be a greater need for that kind of thing, too. Do you quilt every day? I know you're one of those celebrities. But do you try to quilt every day when you're around, when you're in town?
Absolutely. I like to say, I just figured this out. I writing is how I order reality. Like, I can't really make sense of this world until I write it down. So writing is how I order reality, but patchwork and quilting is how I escape from it. I'll tonight, if I get home before too long, I can walk home, which is pretty cool. I'll sew tonight because I took a nap, so I'd be full of energy for you.
You're full energy.
Good. So I got pep, and I'll probably go home and watch some dumb video or some Netflix thing, you know, and I'll sew tonight. And
that's
love it.
Mary, it is really a great pleasure getting to know you. I wish I had seen you perform your poetry, but maybe I will get
maybe
to do
you will.
That
from time to time.
One day, you can learn more about Mary by going to her website. You'll find where her TV show is and when you can watch that at maryfons.com. She's an Iowa kid.
Yeah. I got a blog on that website, Paper Girl.
That's right. You have a blog on the website. You have all sorts of things.
Yeah.
An Amazon author page. You're on Facebook. You do it all. It's a great play. It's a really great pleasure, and I will see you again.
I hope so.
You're going to be a story.
Oh, yeah.
I want to see one. I also so want to see in person one
bring
of your quilts.
I almost brought them tonight. I'm going to bring them. I'm going to cover this place.
Good. It's great to meet you. Well, you too is, I think, playing at Soldier Field right now. But you too's time has come and gone, and now it is time for White Mystery. It is a real treat for me to have Alex and Francis Scott Key White in here. Is that your real name, Francis?
Yes, sir.
It is?
Yep.
Your parents named you Francis Scott Key White.
Yes, my father's name is Francis Lee White. And my grandfather's name is Francis White, and my great-grandfather's name is Francis Scott Key.
We don't have to go back any further. We don't have to go back
only
any further.
Only four.
These two young musicians I first met at a, kind of must be 3 years ago or so, at a Chicago Live performance, that crazy, eclectic show we used to do at the Chicago Theater and then at the Up Comedy Club, and I was really taken with them, not just because of their red hair, not just because they were brother and sister, but they were rock and rollers of the sort that I grew up with. I mean, you guys reminded me, I know you're just a twosome, but you reminded me like of The Who. And you were also extraordinarily nice, articulate, and I'm going to call you kids, and I can do that because I'm old, okay? Do you mind if I keep referring to you as kids? Okay, young people, because you got the whole hour, we're going to play some music here. I interviewed a band called Molehill recently in the paper, and I asked them a question I hadn't asked anybody in a long time. I've asked writers why they write, but I haven't asked musicians, and I asked them and got some very interesting answers. And it's a stupid question, but it's a logical question. Why do you make music, Alex?
The reason why I play music is because I am innately compelled to do so, and have been actually since I heard The Who for the first time.
Is that right?
So I was in fourth grade. I was about 11 years old.
In Chicago. You guys grew up in Chicago.
We're from West Ridge / West Rogers Park, up on the north side. Chicago Public School System graduates all the way through. And, you know, it's the time in the 90s when everyone's rebuying their vinyl collections on compact disc.
Yeah.
So my parents are repurchasing, you know, the Stones, the Beatles, all of these, you know, awesome artists on CD. So I hear Baba O'Reilly, you know, Teenage Wasteland.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being in the living room of our two flat and having my little skirt out and just twirling and just feeling so just overwhelmed by how great it sounded, and started playing guitar.
I'm not trying to make too much of it, but it hit you obviously on a very visceral level, right?
Yeah, it was the eureka moment. It was the lightning bolt. And I started playing in bands. Learned electric guitar. Go, go, go. It wasn't to become a rock star
one day. Yeah,
it's because it feels so good to play music. And being able to play with my brother Francis and now tour the world professionally is just incredible. And it's an adventure.
I'm sure every gig is an adventure of a different sort. And you two play a lot. Francis, what was it for you? You two didn't start playing together until about 10 years ago. But for you, why do you play music? Yeah, I know. It's a crazy, idiotic question, but
I guess I sort of have to. I don't have a choice anymore.
Yeah. Did you at one point have a choice? Were you dancing around the house listening to The Who when you were a kid?
Yeah, I was always a music fan. I always loved music. I guess there's not much else I could have done as well as this.
That's the way I feel about writing, too. What's the age difference between you two?
We're 2 years apart.
That's close. That's very close. Tell me more about your parents. I know your mom's a photographer, right?
Yeah. She would have liked to have been here tonight, actually.
She should have come.
Yeah.
What's she doing? Is she at the U2 concert? Tell me no.
She is not.
Okay.
But she is a rock and roller, but more of the kind of Zeppelin, Stones, you know, Stevie Ray Vaughan kind of. She loved the Dead.
Yeah.
She was pregnant with Francis when she was supposed to see Stevie Ray Vaughan at Alpine Valley, and we all know what happened there. So our mom, Diane Alexander White, is an awesome photographer, also lifelong Chicagoan, South Shore, and went on to be a photographer at the Field Museum for 25 years. But way before that, she was at UIC, and she was capturing Maxwell Street. Disco Demolition is really her, you know, the thing that she's very much associated with, because she got the pictures of all the fans.
Yeah.
Where, you know, the Tribune photographers, they're on the field. They're checking out what's happening from the field and the dugout.
They were all scared, too.
You know, back in 1979. But here's our mom, who was a spectator.
Yep.
So she's getting the faces, the real faces of these people wearing Judas Priest T-shirts and carrying these records, the debauchery, right? But she was also a natural history photographer after that.
Yeah. What'd your dad do?
He's an attorney. Yeah. Frank White. The other Francis White.
The other one.
Yeah.
And
he's very smart, and he's
So you were products kind of a rock and roll house. I mean, this was the music, the soundtrack of your parents' life, right? When you started playing, Francis, did you start playing the drums? That's what my brother did, and it drove my parents crazy.
Yes, my parents helped me purchase my first drum set.
Reluctantly or with...
No, they were very encouraging. Alex was already playing guitar. She went to Old Town School of Folk Music for a couple lessons. When she first got started, she got a cute Dan Electro. And a couple years later, I followed suit and got a drum set. And we actually did start playing together off the bat, not in bands or formal projects immediately, but I learned how to play my instrument by jamming with Alex and learned about songwriting and structure.
Did you have no formal training on the drums then?
I took drum lessons for about a year from a teacher, Mike August, but I got as far as a single stroke roll and a 4/4 beat, and I sort of went from there, and that's about it. I didn't stick to my rudiments or
anything. When does
it
even occur to you, given the intense joy you both obviously get and did get from music, when does it occur to you that maybe this is something, because this is a huge leap for any musician, that you might be able to do this for the rest of your life?
Yeah. Well, you know, actually, it was a specific sort of combination of ingredients that happened in a short period of time that allowed this to happen professionally. So, you know, after the whole teenagehood, and I went to DePaul University, had this record label going.
Business,
I studied business, entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
You know, so I had started a record label when I was 17. So went to school for business, used that as my model throughout my academic career, and was able to really have fun with that, and played in bands. So instead of walking across the stage on my college graduation day, I was in Europe, you know, touring with my band at the time, which was called Miss Alex White and the Red Orchestra. And after being in all these groups, and with different people, realized that my calling was to play with my brother, right? So it's like, okay, Fran, it's time.
Was there an epiphany? Was it that Francis was saying, hey, come on, why don't we play together? What made that happen?
It was finding a White Mystery Airheads candy wrapper on the ground.
Is that really true?
It's true. Where it's like, you know, it's a silver wrapper. It was kind of reflective, and of course I've seen them before because it's the candy that gets sold at record stores,
right,
a common kind. But I looked down, I was like, oh man, Fran, you know, and called up Fran, and I literally called you, and it was like, it's time. It's
Fran,
time to
were
start
you doing
this band.
Now?
Probably playing video games at the time.
With any intention? I mean, did you want, I mean, obviously you wanted to play. If, ladies and gentlemen, if you ever see these two together and you can get their schedule, we'll talk about it. Because they're here for the whole hour at whitemysteryband.com. They play a lot and all over the place. And catch them when they're in the United States, will you please? Was it ever your ambition, Francis, to play with your sister professionally?
Yes, absolutely. It was a dream of mine for years, and I was waiting patiently. There was an opportunity, the aforementioned European tour. I might have been able to hop on it because her drummer in that band had pancreatitis and would have had to miss a week or two of the tour, but I couldn't get my passport in time. But there was a glimmer for a second, maybe as a teenager I might be able to do something. But yeah, it didn't come until I turned 21. At that point, I guess I was a bit more mature and ready and physically capable of.
Where'd you go to college?
I went to Columbia College. Chicago.
What'd you study?
Video game design.
Yeah. Sorry?
Video game design.
Really? Mm-hmm. Really interesting. These are two fascinating people, Alex and Francis White of the band White Mystery. You're going to hear some music. We're going to talk some more about the creative process. They're a brother and sister band of Greek heritage, it turns out. It turns out. Welcome back. I am here for this entire hour with White Mystery. I have now become such good friends with Francis Scott Key White that I can call him Fran. And Alex, I'll just call you Alex. They're a brother and sister team that writes their own stuff that is very business savvy, in part because Alex got a degree in business from DePaul University. I think right now is a perfect time, if it's okay with you two, to hear them. These two are rock and rollers, and the reason I fell for them immediately on stage at, I think we were playing at the Chicago Theater at a Chicago Live segment as we talked backstage for a while, and I liked them. And then I heard them play, and I thought, oh, my God, this is the kind of rock and roll I grew up with. So here they are. I don't know what album this is on or CD or whatever it is. This is Bad Neptune.
Why don't know if they're
That's White Mystery, ladies and gentlemen. Fran Scott Key White and Alex White, brother and sister team that is the band. They both sing. She plays guitar. He plays drums. Do you collaborate on songs? How is that? What is that process like, you two?
Well, so the songwriting
And what is this song? Where's this song from?
Right, so this song that you just heard, Radioland, Bad Neptune, is off the new White Mystery album. It's our 8th annual release. We put a new album out every year on April 20th, like clockwork, since we started.
Anything specific about that date?
It's our band anniversary, so when we found that little silver wrapper.
Yeah.
You know, we back in the MySpace days, right, Fran?
MySpace.
You know, that actually, they actually said, you know, when you created your little band profile, it said, you know, this is your founding date.
Founding date, sure.
And it's a loaded date for a lot of different reasons, the April 20th date.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, so we've been very consistent. And over that period of time, the way that we write songs has transformed quite a bit.
Give me an example.
So in the first...
When White Mystery was formed and you finally got the chance to play with your sis, was there a hierarchy there? Was it like, hey, you're 2 years younger and I'm smarter and I'm a grown-up and I'm your sister and my red hair is a little curlier than yours, so I'm going to be the lead songwriter. What was it like at first? Or was it just...
That very much happened. My sister sat me down for a lunch meeting at the job we worked together, Busy Beaver, and she was like, all right, I've been in a bunch of other bands, and I'm way smarter than you, so I'm going to cut you out of the production company I'm starting. And I burst into tears and felt really bad, and then she changed her mind.
And now what?
And now we own it together.
It's a 50-50 partnership.
Is it a 50-50 writing partnership?
Isn't it a woman-owned business now?
Yeah,
no,
that's right.
It's...
Yeah, it can be when you need it to be. Yeah, I get it. But any artistic collaborative endeavor has ever intrigued me. Lennon-McCartney intrigues me, of course. Mm-hmm. How does it work for the two of you?
Well, it started in the early days where I would say, here's a song, you know, here's the power chords, let's jam it out in the basement, here's some sort of idea of a chorus that I think would be cool, and we'll just kind of fill in the rest. Now, you know, in this period of time, we've written 100 songs.
Wow.
1 year, we kind of surprised all of our fans by putting out a feature-length film.
I know.
Called
I
That
know.
Was Awesome.
I know.
And created the soundtrack for that. And that was really a big breakthrough for us creatively on how we collaborate, where we really started leveraging our strengths. So I'm great at organizing, and Francis is an exceptional writer. He's an amazing writer. So a lot of my songs are just so basic, kind of silly sometimes. And Francis's songs are poetry. They flow.
But almost too much. We meet in the middle a bit. It's really nice how straightforward Alex's approach is to music, whereas mine might be a bit too garbled sometimes. I might be trying to fit too many emotions or ideas into my lyrics, and Alex can streamline it effectively, so it's a nice middle ground.
What inspires your lyrics? Is it day-to-day life? Is it observation? Is it reading? Is it... other music? Is it all of those things?
Mostly excruciating nerve pain. I deal with a medical condition. I have a tumor on my nerve, my sciatic nerve. It's inoperable and growing. And I try not to use that entirely as my inspiration, but I get a lot of dark, subversive lyrical content
really?
Out of being in excruciating pain all day, yes.
What do you take for your pain?
I have my Illinois medical marijuana card.
Do you?
Yeah.
Do you? That's very smart.
Yeah.
That's very smart.
He's been through a lot.
How old are you two?
I'm 32.
So you're 30.
I'm about to be 30 in August, yeah.
And you have been out and about a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, what the nature of I know you're extraordinarily popular here and you have a big, sort of big fan base here. Don DeGrazia among your biggest fans, and Dave Hoekstra among your biggest fans. Is it tough to leave, or you're going to be on? You know, you guys are going to be on for the whole hour. We can get into a lot of this stuff later. What do your parents? What do your folks think of White Mystery?
I mean, I know that our parents are definitely our biggest fans.
How often do they come see you perform?
In the early days, they had to come every time because we were underage.
Yeah.
So they were, you know, driving the Dodge Caravan when I was definitely, you know, 15 and didn't even have a license. But our mom has been very helpful. You know, it's not really like the kind of thing where it's like a Lindsay Lohan or a Hanson thing where your parents are your manager. They're more just kind of encouraging for us and supportive.
Yeah, you don't come off like Lindsay Lohan.
You don't come off like some spoiled kid. But we're lucky because I think that having that sort of support that when you're all the way over in Japan or you're in, you know, driving through the Swiss Alps and experiencing tornadoes in Mississippi and all this wild stuff that happens out on the road on these adventures, it's like you have a support system to come home to.
Well, and the other aspect of it too, though your mom as a photographer did have a straight job, it's amazing, I think, for parents to, and it's not allowing, but to kind of sign off on a artistic life, because your mom knows photography, and someone like that would know the price that is often paid for a full-time commitment to the arts, don't you both think?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because of the time that we grew up, you know, so like this moment in time, this capsule, this, you know, these couple decades that we've been experiencing with technology allowing us to do what we do, you know, what has happened with kind of like the dot-com bubble and then the dot-com bust and, you know, all of the recession and both of our parents also becoming self-employed.
Yeah.
You know, and but that giving us, you know, like a permission by observation, permission by example. So it's like, you know what, it might be challenging, but it's nothing that anyone hasn't been able to conquer before.
I also think your mom and even your dad, I mean, there's some creativity in being a lawyer. But I think your mom understands the rewards of a creative lifestyle. You guys, you're going to hear more songs. You're going to hear Can't Stand It. You're going to hear Full of Light. And if we get a chance, you're going to hear Black Heart Crusader, too, from White Mystery. I can call him Fran now, but I really like his full name, Francis Scott Key White and Alex White. She's 2 years older. They both have red hair, and they're both Greek. This is Chicago's very own, and they have a brother. We haven't even talked about your brother. Rick Hogan in here on the After Hours show with the brother and sister team of Francis, I love the name, Francis Scott Key White and his elder sister, Alex. They're both still really kids. Their band is White Mystery. You can get all sorts of information at whitemysteryband.com. One of the reasons that that this website is so good, I think, is because Alex has a degree in business from DePaul, right? Fran and I didn't think much of college, so we're just trying to get by on what we got. The music business, when you guys, in your time in it, has so radically changed from the days when I was seeing The Who and even when you were falling in love with The Who. It is a terribly wicked business now, especially the recording aspect of it. You know, years ago when Sergeant Pepper, 50 years ago yesterday or whatever it was, when Sergeant Pepper was created, it was created because there was a narrative to the album. And the Beatles decided, well, we'd like you to hear this song and then this song and then this song and then this song and then this song, and that's the whole album. That's so vastly different now. How do you adjust to that world? You just write the best songs you can and let people digest them in whatever fashion they want to?
No, I think we force it down people's throats a bit more than that.
Yeah, I think you do too, and I'm intrigued, but I think you do too.
It's we believe in bold movements and believing in what you do and stand for and say, and not mincing your words or beating bushes or anything like that, and just going for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, one of the advantages of being a completely independent band is that you can do whatever pleases you.
You can be independent.
Yeah. So
let's listen to another tune. Talk to me for a second before we play it about Can't Stand It.
Can't Stand It is one of my favorite songs off of the new album, which will abbreviate to FYMS.
Yes, you have to abbreviate it.
Yeah.
You can figure out why by going to whitemysteryband.com.
Right. But we recorded this new album here in Chicago. We recorded our albums all around the country. This one was up on Irving and Lincoln, basically, with Mr. Steve Gillis at Transient Sound. And you can really hear that we've matured with our recording process with this particular song, Can't Stand It.
Have a listen, ladies and gentlemen. The latest album, which we can't say on the air here, but you can certainly find out what it's called at whitemysteryband.com. That's another great song. That is another great song from Fran and Alex White of White Mystery. You do extensive, when you go on your website and see, well, first, tell people where you're going to play in the next few weeks here. You're in Chicago.
Yeah. So coming up Saturday, June 10th, which is next weekend, in Logan Square, Hipsterville.
Yes.
Milwaukee and Medill. There's a bar called the East Room. And behind that club, there's a little street called Medill. And for the third year in a row, we're organizing.
Named after the founder of the Tribune.
Really?
Joseph Medill, yeah.
Fun fact.
Small world.
We're hosting the third annual Rock and Roll Market, which is an outdoor free event that we organize with Do312.
Mm-hmm.
60 vendors, cool music gear, vinyl, vintage clothes. What we sound like is the sort of stuff that you can get there.
Yeah.
Food trucks, rock and roll DJs, five bands, Yoko and the Onos, Flesh Panthers, The Evictions, and Easy Habits, and White Mystery. So it's free. That's happening June 10th, which is Saturday, between noon and 7 p.m. So it's a daytime affair.
Yeah, all day.
Yeah.
And where you've played the Hideout. You've played every everywhere in Chicago, right? Double Door, all these joints. How do you you're obviously the booker too for this. How does that? How hard is that? To sort of constantly be calling, are you constantly calling clubs? And I'm simply talking here now, not
in Chicago.
Your international work. I don't even have any idea how that happens. How does it happen here for you?
Well, in Chicago,
obviously you're known,
right?
And you can draw a crowd because you have a lot of fans here.
Absolutely. So White Mystery's played Millennium Park, Taste of Chicago, Riot Fest many years. And the way it just happens, it's like a give and take between people emailing you and asking you whether you'd like to play.
Gotcha.
And in other cases, you know, that looks like something cool we'd like to do and finding the path to accomplishing it.
You've done a lot of international touring, a lot of national touring and international. Forgive my naivete, but how does that happen? I mean, how do you guys get booked in Japan, for instance?
Well, the way that happened, and, you know, White Mystery's played almost 1,000 shows now.
I know.
Yeah, we still haven't played Lala or Pitchfork.
Yeah.
Or the Aragon or the Riff.
Yeah, so those are still TB.
Despite our best efforts.
Yeah, we've contacted.
Why do you think that is?
You know, why would.
Because you guys,
they're all a bunch of Satanists.
Good answer.
You know, why would a four-day festival like Lollapalooza that books, I think, something like 400 bands.
Yeah.
Chance the Rapper's headlining. He's from Chicago.
Right.
There are some Chicago acts on it, but really it's you know, we've contacted them many years in a row. And
that's a shame.
We've played big festivals worldwide, and yet Lollapalooza won't book us here in Chicago. And why they won't remains to be answered.
Well, you guys know in the same way, and ask your mom. I mean, there's politics involved in galleries. There's politics involved. You would like to think that politics does not get involved in any art form.
It's because we blow all those bands off the stage.
That's right.
Big time.
And they don't want you there.
Yeah. But at the same time,
The Killers are saying, no, we can't have a White Mystery.
And
there.
Dude, what happens behind the curtain is.
Oh, I can only imagine.
You know, that's a book.
Only imagine.
That's a book.
I've got these lovely people, Fran and Alex White of White Mystery. Go to whitemysteryband.com and you'll get all sorts of information about them, where they're playing. You can buy stuff. And you'll hear one more song and we'll talk for a few more minutes with these smart, nice people. I wanted a couple more questions. I want to know about the. You guys work so hard, and I want to know, after this little break, what kind of lives can you have? I know you're 30 and 32, and that you're young, and you should be doing this now because you can't be doing it. Well, look, Paul McCartney still does it. The Stones still do it. The Who still does it. You can't be doing this when you're my age. But I want to know what that kind of life on the road is like for you two. We'll be right back. I have a few more minutes with White Mystery, otherwise known as Francis Scott Key White, and his big sister, Alex White. Go to whitemysteryband.com. You guys are smart, and you are really talented. You are on the road all the time. What kind of quality of life sacrifices do you have to make to do that? I'm sure it is a ball, because every city's new, every crowd is new. You're still at the age where I'm sure it is a ball, and you're meeting new people, and the traveling is exciting. Does it ever get you down?
It's exhausting to be in danger constantly.
Danger
when you're looking
what?
Out, the elements, people, cars, deer,
life.
Life in general, your own body.
Yeah. Stage collapsing, whatever. Yeah. Fire at the venue, which happened once.
Rock and roll does not take place in a safe work environment. Despite the venue's best efforts, some do better jobs than others. Some DIY venues that we play are safer than other ones and yada yada. But it's exhausting just being on guard and trying to maintain your adrenaline and concentration and stamina over the course of months just traveling across the city.
Yeah, that's well put, Fran. I'm sure it is. When you come back to Chicago, you guys don't seem to kind of unwind, and you don't have the kind of Led Zeppelin money to go take a month-long vacation on some Caribbean island.
Ooh,
I do. Alex doesn't.
You're Alex stealing comes from back the company.
And, Alex comes back and starts doing 150 emails a day, and I just try to relax while I'm home.
Yeah. I'm a work hard, play hard person, for sure.
Yeah.
So we get home from tour, and I have to just run and lift weights and compulsively clean my house.
Do you two live together in Chicago?
Yes,
we do. It's
What's
great.
That like? You're one day going to maybe fall in love with other people who aren't members of the family and have lives. Does that ever trouble you about, I'm sure you've had boyfriends, girlfriends, whatever, or maybe not.
Well, here's an important...
That's also hard to do with the kind of lifestyle you guys have.
Here's a very important piece of minutia about White Mystery, which is when we started and we found that silver wrapper on April 20th, 2008, we started this band. We said, okay, we're going to do this right. We've learned from, you know, rock and roll history, my previous acts. This is what we have to do. A, we're going to stay independent. And that means independent records, spirit, but also independent, so not really being in relationships.
Yeah.
So when we're overseas, you're not clouded by what might be happening at home. And technically, our 10-year pact for that...
is up next year.
It's up next year. So there was other
things.
You guys
can't even, like, have a dog.
We have a dog.
You do have a dog?
But it's our parents' dog.
Oh, okay.
Devo, the dog. But he's not a whippet.
So what next year when that deadline comes, what do? You could commit, I suppose, for let's do this for 5 more years, let's do this for 10 more years, or, and you obviously have ambitions, and you obviously are terribly, it can't just be, hey, I want to be in Pitchfork or Lollapalooza. It's got to be bigger than that. You made a movie.
Yep. We've put out guitar pedals, you know, really fun merchandising where it's enjoyable and pleasurable to develop all of these cool things. So next year when this opens up, you know, we'll be White Mystery forever. We agreed upon that, you know, Fran, right? It's just that it might take on a new form.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Film intriguing
TBD,
to you?
TBD, right? So to be determined on what that will look like. And I think that we're even curious about what it'll look like.
Sure.
The thing that's fun,
well, 10
though,
years, the other thing, you two, is 10 years is a long time to be together. It is a, I'm not saying that disparagingly, it's a durable time. That says a great deal, I think, about the kind of people you are to be able to do that creatively. And these, you know, the songs we're playing are your latest creations. That shows tremendous growth, I think.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. You guys lived up to everything I knew and thought you'd be. I've seen you perform a few times and enjoyed it every time and enjoyed all the times we've talked. What do you want to hear is you can get to walk out the door and you can go home and go to sleep or whatever you do at 11 o'clock on a Sunday night. You want to hear Blackheart Crusader?
Yeah, we could do that. What are
or
other options?
Full of Light.
Oh, Full of Light. Let's play that again.
Okay.
Is that okay? Or did you want to hear Blackheart Crusader, Fran?
Blackheart Crusader?
I think Full of Light is just like a real crowd pleaser, so we'll see what Radioland says.
You audience would like to be pleased now. We'll play Full of Light, and we will let these nice two young people go home.
Thank you, Rick. You're awesome.
Thanks so much, Rick.
This
was a great time.
It was fascinating to me, you guys, and I really wish you success, and I can't wait to talk next year and see where you're going. We'll be right back. That was another tune from the latest album by White Mystery. This was an interesting show for me, ladies and gentlemen, to talk for an hour with a talented woman, Mary Fonz, about her life and career as a slam poet, as an actress in Chicago, and also as a quilter. She goes around the country. For those of you who didn't hear that, Lise Graham will post that interview. It was really, really interesting. And then these two nice young people, Francis Scott Key White and his older sister Alex, of the band White Mystery. I met them, as I said, at a Chicago Live performance kind of 3 or 4 years ago, and they were in their mid-20s, and just were very, very taken with their, not just with their music, but with their personalities. And I'm ever, ever intrigued by what drives creative people. They don't all share anything genetic, but they certainly share a passion, not just to perform, but to create. So, hope you enjoyed it. You also heard Corky Siegel and his Chamber Blues. As always, Aubrey Mumpower makes this engine run smoothly. And the great Lise Graham, who now has 80 podcasts at Lise FM. One of these weeks we'll get more into her. She's come on very strong. She will one day run this entire station. And of